Well, you will get to hear me some more. This is really weird, by the way. Like, usually in Czech, you know, this would be all empty here. Like, there would be no people. So I usually come down and, like, stand right there. So it's great. I don't have to do that. Up on the chair. Some time ago, in one of our churches, I was leading the service, right? And I came up like Steve did today, and I greeted everybody, and I looked around, and it was a rhetorical question. I said, so why are we here today? And then I wasn't expecting any answers. Usually you don't get any in church, right? And and then right over there, there was a woman who's been with us from the very beginning, right, of the church, 11 years or 12 years, and she looked at me and she says, like, I'd really like to know that. And I'm like, what? You know? But it was I really didn't expect that, but it was a great reminder, at least for me, that it is really easy to forget. Why are we here today? Why do we believe God? Why do we follow Jesus? And today, I think I want to speak more specifically about what do we do? How do we believe God, and how do we follow Jesus when things don't go the way that we planned? What are we going to do? So what will you do? What will we do when the things don't go as we planned? And I think we all have experienced this in our lives where, you know, we had a certain idea of what our lives will look like, and then it's completely different, and maybe in a way that we weren't expecting, and are maybe nothing like what we were expecting. So a couple stories that I've kind of experienced this. Some time ago, I've met with this young woman in our church, and she came to me because she wanted to talk about something. She said, I got married when I was 22 years old, and my husband was 23, and we got married, and there were six couples kind of the same age that were getting married at the same time, and now it has been 4 years, and three of those couples are divorced now. And they're all Christian couples. And she said, like, we all knew each other, and I was kind of the most mature, so some of those people that were getting divorced kind of were talking to me about their problems and things. And so she wanted to ask me what I would tell them. And the story of those three couples were almost the identical. And she said, we talked, and they said, well, we were thinking that when we get married, it will be different. It will somehow solve problems in our lives or something. And then it didn't. I guess everybody's married in this room because you're all laughing, right? That's the way it is. And they said, we thought we will be happy when we're together. And we're not. And of course, God doesn't want us to be unhappy, right? So why would we stay together when we're unhappy? So what would you tell her, right? How would you help her when you had an idea of what things will be and they're not, and then what do you do? The other example, recently I talked to a friend of mine. He's my age, and he has been very active in church for probably 20 years as a volunteer. He was never paid in ministry, but he was doing a lot of things. He sacrificed greatly to the ministry and serving God in 20 years. And we haven't seen each other for quite a while, and then we got together, and I was like, so what are you doing now? He says, yeah, we kind of gave up on everything in church. We come sometimes, but not a whole lot. And he said, we need to focus more on family and things now. And I talked to him about that, and he mentioned again the same thing. He said, I thought it would be different, serving God and being in ministry. And he said, when we were young, we would go to all these conferences for young people, youth conferences, leadership conferences, you know, and we were all, like, they were all trying to hype us up, like, that, you know, you're the most important thing in a church, and God has a great plan for your life, and you will accomplish great things for God. And I've been doing this for 20 years, and I have a mortgage, I have three kids, I have a boring job, and nothing, like, I haven't accomplished anything. And I thought it would be different. So, what do you do? when you were, you had an idea of what your life will be, and then it's different than you thought. So this is what I want to talk about today, and we're going to be looking at the very well-known story that Jesus told. And this story, we're going to be looking at Luke 19, starting at verse 11. And this story is called Parable of the Minas. I think this is what they call it here. But there's another version of it in the Gospel of Matthew in 25th chapter. It's twice there in the Gospels. And each time it's a little bit different. And I think those differences can actually help us understand a little bit more about the story, why it's there. That's what we're going to be talking about. So if you have Bibles, Luke 19, starting at verse 11, I'll read it through and then we'll talk about it. While they were listening to him, he went on to tell them a parable, because he was near Jerusalem and the people thought that the kingdom of God was going to appear at once. He said, "A man of a noble birth went to a distant country to have himself appointed a king and then to return. So he called 10 of his servants and gave them 10 minas. 'Put this money to work,' he said, 'until I come back.' But his subjects hated him and sent a delegation after him to say, 'We don't want this man to be our king.' He was made king, however, and returned home. Then he sent for the servants to whom he had given the money in order to find out what they had gained with it. The first one came and said, 'Sir, your mina has earned 10 more.' 'Well done, my good servant,' his master replied, 'because you have been trustworthy in a small matter, take charge of 10 cities.' The second came and said, 'Sir, your mina has earned 5 more.' His master answered, 'You take the charge of 5 cities.' Then another servant came and said, 'Sir, here is your mina. I have kept it laid away in a piece of cloth. I was afraid of you because you are a hard man. You take out what you didn't put in and you reap what you didn't sow.' His master replied, 'I will judge you by your own words, you wicked servant. You knew, didn't you, that I am a hard man, taking out what I didn't put in and reaping what I didn't sow. Why then didn't you put my money on a deposit so that I can, so that when I come back, I would have collected it with interest?' Then he said to those standing by, 'Take his mina away from him and give it to the one who has 10 minas.' 'Sir,' they said, 'he already has 10. He replied, 'I tell you that to everyone who has, more will be given. But as for the one who has nothing, even what they have will be taken away. But those enemies of mine who didn't want me to be king over them, bring them here and kill them in front of me.'" That's a good ending of the story, right? Jesus with a lamp in the picture, just kill those enemies. So I tell you, usually when I've heard this parable or the other one, which is called the parable of the talent, they are the same story, right, with differences. Usually how it was interpreted, how we talked about it, was, God is giving to every one of us a talent, some skill, something that we're good at. And the goal of our life is to find it and then somehow develop it into, so that we can bring something back to God through the talent that he gave us, right? We should be like the first two servants. Like, we bring back something that with what God has given us. And we shouldn't be like the third guy, right, who buries it. So we shouldn't bury our talents and skills and all that kind of stuff. We should be developing them, right? You've heard that before, right? Good, right? So it became more like a self-help, self-development parable, right? Jesus was a guru with the microphone, like, on the stage, telling people to be better, but the best version of themselves, right? Whenever I heard this, like, I always had a problem. I don't know if you noticed, but I'm kind of a curious person, to put it nicely. And I always had a problem with it. And the way that the process of not really sitting well with me started when I noticed this one thing, that usually when we discussed talents, like what the talents were, it would be like that. So it would usually be things that were like helpful in a church. So like there's a bunch of kids in our church who likes to play with the Rubik's Cube. Anybody into Rubik's Cube here? Oh, there you go. Yeah. So they can, I don't know how they do it, but they can like take it and do like And it's like they finish it in like 5 seconds or something, and I don't know how they do it. But nobody would look at that and say, hey, God gave you this talent, you just should run with it, right? Nope, we never do that. But when there is somebody who can play like a guitar, right, we would go to him and say like, hey, you know, God has given you this talent, you should really like develop it and work with it. And the difference was that we can use the worship leaders in the church, right, but we don't know what to do with the kid with a Rubik's Cube. So I was like, it's really weird. So that was kind of my like first hint with why it didn't really work for me. This explanation never worked for me. And then I started to kind of dig into it and see how did that happen? Like, why do we use this explanation of the story? And this comes, so this is from the Matthew's version of this story, where in Greek he uses the word talentos there, which is translated talents into English and into Czech and in basically all the other languages. But the word talentos, and it's very tempting in our languages to kind of think about it as a talent, as a skill, as something that, you know, of that nature. But talentos basically means a bag of gold in Greek. It's a measurement of wealth, of money. And nobody really knows how big it is, but some of the newer English translations, if you have some of newer ones, they would translate it as a bag of gold, which I really like. So so the talents or the minas are a measurement of money that the master is giving to the servants. And so the question is, of course, what in the parable are the bags of gold? And let's go to this one. I think the answer is in the second part of the verse. At least, why I think it's not the skills and the usual interpretation we have. Because if you read the second part of the verse, you read, he gave talents to one, to each according to his own ability. So the people were give, like if we would think about it as skills, this verse would say, God gave skills to people according to their skills. Which I was like, that doesn't really translate well, right? And no matter how you think about it, like, you know, God gave, like, if sometimes we talk about talents as time or money. Like, is it really that we believe that God gives each one of us a measure of time in our life based on our abilities? That's not true, right? Or wealth based on our abilities? I don't think that's true either. So, I'm not against like self-help, self-development. I like to read those books and stuff. I think it's useful, but I wouldn't say it's based on this parable. So what is it about? What is it actually about? What I think it's about? I think when we look at the version that Jesus was talking about in the Gospel of Luke we've read, he gives us a hint about what he's talking about there. So this is the beginning, the first verse, and the word because, it's really important there. Like if you read the whole thing, Jesus says, while they were listening to this, he went to tell them a parable, and because they were nearing Jerusalem, and the people thought that the kingdom of God was going to appear at once. So what is happening there is, through the Gospel of Luke, if you read the Gospel of Luke, there are some hints some of the stories that Jesus is trying to explain to his disciples in different ways what is going to happen when they get to Jerusalem. And they're not getting it. And this is one of those examples. So they're going to Jerusalem. This is maybe a week or 2 weeks before Jesus gets crucified, right? And it's a Passover time. That's really important, because what is the Passover time or Passover story in the Bible about? Well, it's about liberation from slavery, right? The Israel nation was enslaved in Egypt, and the Passover was time when they were set free, right? And what is the time of Jesus like? Well, it's a time of slavery where the Jews are again enslaved by the Romans. And it's Passover, the time of liberation. And the society is again, there's a turmoil in society again every Passover. There's the hope of freedom There's a hope of liberation from the Roman Empire. So the people that are following Jesus have this idea. We will get to Jerusalem and we will start a rebellion against Romans. And because we have the Messiah, the person that, you know, is God that came to this earth to set us free, we will get to Jerusalem. They will be fighting, but because we have a Messiah, we will win and we will drive the Romans away from our land, from a promised land, and we will be free. Jesus' followers have clear expectation what will happen when they get to Jerusalem. But we know what Jesus knew back then, that is not going to happen. That is not what it is going to be like when they get to Jerusalem. It will be very different. And since it is not what is going to be happening, Jesus is telling them this parable, that are concerning what will happen next week in Jerusalem when they get there. So Jesus is talking and preparing his disciples as they're getting to Jerusalem that things that will happen will be very different from what they're expecting. And the way he does it, the whole parable actually is not something that Jesus would made up, but it's a very familiar story that the Jews knew, and it was a story of I'm sorry, I know it's boring. We'll get to the good part, and it's a very very familiar story that the Jews knew that happened about 30 years ago. If you've ever been in church on Christmas, you probably have heard about Herod the Great, right? The guy that murdered all the babies, right? Another great story, by the way. And Herod the Great, when he died, he had three sons. And one of them was about to become a king after him. And back then, in order to become a king in Israel, because Israel was under Roman occupation, you would have to go to Rome and be appointed king by a Caesar. So that's what this guy did, one of the Herod's son, went to Rome and was appointed by Caesar a king. But as the Jews didn't like the Herod the Great, they didn't like his son either, so they sent a delegation to Rome after him to tell the Caesar that they don't want him to be a king. So they got there, they told Caesar. Caesar didn't care because who are these Jews to listen to, right? So he appointed Herod's son the king. He came back to Israel after being appointed a king and did what all the kings do, right? He killed the Jews that went to Rome to protest his coronation. And that's the story that Jesus is using here. This is the story. The king has now returned, and that's the focus of the story, is on what happens when the king returns. Because if you look even at the amount of text, like the introduction when the king is leaving and he's giving away the minas, it's kind of like an introduction of the story. And then the most of the story is kind of focused on what happens when the king gets back. And the focus of the story is on the characters in the story and on the decision that they make. That's the important part. How individual characters, what decisions do they make concerning this king? And it's a challenge to make a decision. Jesus is saying, we will come to Jerusalem in a week, and you have to decide where you stand. Will you stand with me as a king? Even though it will probably look completely different than what you thought it will look like. Or will you not? Will you be those who remain faithful and continue to serve? Or will you be like the one who knows very well what is it about, but would rather bury the money? Or will you be like those that don't want me to be the king at all? Like all the crowds that at some point they cheer for Jesus and then that a week later they yell crucify him. So which one of you will be? Jesus is preparing them for what will happen and says, think about upfront about what will you do when things will not go the way you expected. So I started to be in a ministry about 20 years ago. And back then, I was 22, and I wasn't very smart, by the way. I'm still not, but it was way worse then. And what happened to me, I was smart enough to know that I shouldn't, like, as a 22-year-old, I shouldn't probably start alone. I should be under, like, an older pastor, which the board of our denomination actually agreed with, and they sent me to this church to work with this older pastor. So we were getting to move 20 years ago, and about 2 months before we moved, the older pastor from the church calls me and says, hey, by the way, in the summer, which was, you know, the summer, we're moving out. We're leaving. You'll be alone. And I was like, okay, great. Thank you. And so we moved in. I had no idea. I was 22. I had no idea what's going to be happening. And what happened was that there was an older pastor in a nearby town that kind of took interest in me and was helping me through, you know, the first year when I was there alone. And he was giving me some very helpful and practical advices. Because I was 22, so I had a very clear idea, and I was very convinced about what needs to be happening in the church, right? And so, and I had lots of ideas, which I usually do, but a lot of ideas. How easy it would be to change this 120-year-old church. So I was like, yeah, we'll get in, like, I'll do this, and we'll do that, and like 6 months later, it'll all be different, right? And so I was talking to this older pastor of mine, and he would listen to me. And very, very nicely and very gently, sometimes he would go like, so it would be good if you think about, like, what will you do if things don't really happen the way you planned? And I'm like, why wouldn't they, right? Like, what's wrong with these people? Why wouldn't they want to do what I'm telling them to do? And of course, 6 months later, things didn't happen the way I planned. But I was very, very, very happy that he kind of coached me through this and prepared me for what will happen, what will I do when things don't happen the way I planned. And I think that's exactly what Jesus is doing here. He's preparing the disciples that as they get to Jerusalem, what will you do when things will be different than you expected? So that's, I try to put it in a kind of sentence, the main idea of what I think this is about. And it's a call to decision. It says, King is here. What will you do with him? How will you react to what is Jesus coming with? But if you read the story carefully, there are some problems with it. I don't know if you noticed, but there are some problems people have with this. So what are the problems? When I came to the church in the 90s, I don't know if it was, I think it was the same here as it was in the Czech, but kind of a big thing, what was happening was a focus on apologetics. So a big focus on how to defend the faith against, you know, those who don't believe. So we would be, there would be a lot of discussions that we were printing books back then, you know, evidence that demands a verdict or case for Christ or some of the other ones. They were very popular. They were translated into Czech, and I really liked it. I really enjoyed it, learning these arguments and stuff like that. But what is interesting today, as we work with young people and college students, nobody cares about that. Like, we don't have, like, really argument and discussions, does really God exist, or, like, stuff like that. People don't really care about that. Previously, the biggest problem was proving and convincing people that God exists, or we thought it was. But I'm wondering, and I think I know the answer, but do you think it's the biggest problem today that people don't believe in God? I don't think it is. How many people you know that would be like claiming atheist? Like, we have some of those in Czech, but not actually not a whole lot. In Czech, actually, this is kind of an interesting point that we're considered to be least Christian and most atheistic country. Well, there's probably like 0.3 to 0.5 evangelical Christians in our country. But also, at the same time, we're the most superstitious country in Europe. So we have people going to all of the, like, mediums and astrology and all that kind of stuff at the same time. And it shows that the problem is not that people wouldn't believe that there's something above us, there's God or something higher or whatever you want to call it. And I think this is, but the problem is different. The problem is, there you go. Do I want to follow this God, or is this God worth following? And I think this is what Jesus is talking about here and the problem in this story. I think this problem is represented in the story by the third servant and the enemies. Jesus is saying, you might have a different idea about who God is and what he wants you to do. Your ideas might be different, and then when you meet real God or hear about real God, you will not want to follow him or believe in him because it's so different. Different ideas about how things should be. And this is what Jesus is addressing. His followers thought, we will come to Jerusalem, you know, you will become a king, we'll be killing Romans and stuff, and this will be it. But that's not what is going to happen. That's not who God is. The problem is that they disagree with the idea of what does it mean that Jesus is king and that God exists. And very often this comes from us having a very wrong ideas about who God is. And I think you can if you read plainly the text, you can get some really interesting ideas, right? There is a third servant is talking to the master and he says, "You are a hard person who takes what is not his own." And if we just read it and look at it, is this what God is like? Because God in the story is the representative of the master. The master is the representative of God in the story. So is God hard and takes what is not his? Or if you read to the end, right, the master, the king, tells his servants to bring his enemies and kill them in front of him. Is that who God is? Do you want to believe in such a God? And I think this is the story. This is the question, and this is the story of so many young people I talk to about. I just recently had a conversation with a young couple who was part of our church, and then they left, and they claimed they are not Christians anymore. And they both grew in this conservative environment, and they had a clear idea of what the Bible is and who God is and what he's like. And then they, as they were growing up, they kind of see a bigger world and try to understand, and were understanding a little bit more about what they thought they believe. And they said, we cannot believe in such a God, in a God who kills babies and floods the earth and kills everybody. And I was talking to them. I said, maybe there's a different way to read those stories. Maybe you can look at it in a little bit of a different light. Because I don't believe in such a God who's cruel. And we talked about this, but they couldn't. They were not open to see like any different way to read those stories. It was impossible to reach any agreement, and they left the church. So why should we trust God? And I think that's the question there for those servants and those enemies. They don't want to follow Jesus with the things that he's representing. I think there is a good reason to trust God. Because he turns up all the ideas that we have about him upside down in the story. Is God cruel and strict and hard and takes what is not his own? Well, if you read the story, the whole story, that's not the picture of God you get. God is giving away his minas or talents or the bags of gold to his servants. He's rejoicing when they bring it back. He's happy for them. That's the master. Then there's a third guy who kind of have a weird idea about God, right? But that's not how he's portrayed in the story. Is God someone who kills his enemies in front of him? Well, in the parable, the king kills his enemies. But what does Jesus do very next week after he tells the story? He goes to Jerusalem and he dies for his enemies. Jesus is saying, I'm not like these other kings. I'm not like Herod's son. My kingdom is different. He tells them, do you know the story of Herod's son when he came back from Rome and he killed all his enemies? I am not like that. I am willing to die for my enemies to save them. Jesus' story is better than the story of all kings that have ever been here on this earth. And that's why I think it makes sense for us to believe in God, because he turns upside down all our ideas that we have about him. He's way better than what we think about him. But I think there's a challenge for all of us at the story. Does this different idea about who Jesus is and who God is make sense to us? And how do we respond to it? Do we want to follow this Jesus? Do we want to follow king that lets himself be killed for his enemies? Who says that the way to rule is through sacrifice? Do we want to follow this God? And what does it mean for us, people in the West who have so much power? When he says that those who have power are here to serve, that we should forgive one another, and not only our friends, but our enemies. And Jesus said to forgive our enemies in the context of Roman occupation. So this wasn't like your annoying neighbor, right? It's kind of like, your tree is growing here, like cut it down, and you're like, I hate you, you're my enemy, right? That's not what he's talking about. I use this in a sermon. I said, it's like when you're a Ukrainian who's caught up in the Russian-occupied territories, and you have Russian flags everywhere. That's the context that he's talking about. That we don't have to fear because our Lord is not a harsh and doesn't take what doesn't belong to him. He sacrifices himself for us and gives us what we don't deserve. And in Jesus' time, many people saw miracles, and we sometimes long for it, right? We would like to see the miracles that Jesus did, and we kind of think that, oh, if people just saw the miracles that Jesus did, they would all believe him. Well, that's not the case in the Bible. Why? Well, I think it's because the idea of what was Jesus bringing was so radical and so different than what people were expecting that they said, no, we don't want that. This is such a different idea about who God is that we don't want to follow this. And I think it's the same today. So how will we respond to this Jesus? Will we agree with him? Will we want to live for him and follow him? Or have we heard what he said and we go like, yeah, he's a king, king is here, it's okay. But I'll do it on my own. I think I can do better than that. And what Jesus said. I like the idea of going to heaven when I die. That's awesome. Like everybody wants to do that. But forgiving and sacrificing for others and serving others and all that, I think I can do better than that. Or will we be like his enemies who, when they hear what is Jesus bringing, they go like, this is horrible. We don't want to have anything to do with it. So which ones will you be? And that's kind of a decision that everyone has to make for himself. So when the things don't go your way, what will you do? Why to stay faithful? And I think it goes to the very, very first story I told you about when I was emceeing the service, you know, and there was this lady who didn't know why we're there. You know what I told them? I didn't know what to tell them, to be honest. So, like, I was standing there, I was like, okay, well, let the band come up. So the band came up, and they played a couple of songs, and I was sitting there. I was like, what do I tell them? And then I had an idea. So I told them about a wedding. I love doing weddings, by the way. If you're following me on social media, I'm always there with some couple, you know, that I just married. And I do weddings for many people that they're not even Christians. They just want me to do their wedding. And I do actually more of the weddings for non-Christians than for Christians. And what I do at the wedding, I always, when I speak, I always try to paint the picture of what marriage can be like. Because when we look at the Bible, right, there's a beautiful picture of what marriage can be like. It doesn't mean it will be like that, as we all know. But there's a beautiful, ideal picture of what marriage can be like. You know, when you find somebody in a life that you can go through life that will stay with you even if you're not as beautiful, as rich, as whatever you are at the wedding day. They will stay with you. They will not change you for a new model, you know, all that. Every time when I describe this, you have 50 non-Christian people staring at me and go like, I want somebody like that. And they always, because if we take the idea of marriage as God designed it, it's beautiful. And it's something that it's better than anything else in this world. And so I told them this story, and I told them, this is what the church is supposed to be like. We have met this God who created the world and who has the best idea of what the world should be like. And we get to live it now. The church is supposed to be like the trailer in the movies, right? When you go in there and in 2 minutes, You know, you have all the best action scenes and the most romantic moments and the funniest moments and everything right there in 2 minutes. And the whole purpose of this thing there is that you're sitting there with your wife or somebody and you go like, we have to spend, you know, $30 to see that. That's the whole point of the trailer. And that's what the church is supposed to be like. When people see us, when we live out the idea of what Jesus came up with, they go like, hey, 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 we need to be part of that. And I think that's what it is. That's the reason why it makes sense to follow Jesus. Because of what he brings is way better than anything that we can come up with. Does it make sense?
Yeah.
Good. So I'll ask the band to come up and play the song. And I'll think about, no. Thank you guys for listening.